Now, some of you may have heard of the book, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. It was a bestseller written in 2010 by a lad called Alex Malarkey, co-authored with his father Kevin, about Alex's journey to heaven whilst he was in a coma from an accident, car accident, that actually left him paralyzed. And this has been in the news recently because in January this year, Alex wrote a blog post saying the whole thing was made up, that he did it to get attention, and that he was upset and hurt that people were profiting from it. If you look at certain blogs and things, this caused a bit of a storm. Some people had been so hyped up about this story that then to hear that it was a fabrication was crushing. Others had perhaps been saying all along, sounding warning bells about it. It's a very sad story, and if you're interested, you can just type it into the internet and read about it yourself. But books like that and stories like that of visions of heaven or near-death experiences, it's not surprising that they sell. It's not surprising that they grab the public attention. Because in the same way that we're fascinated by what lies beyond the stars, we're fascinated and eager to know, eager to be reassured what lies beyond death. Many people, even those who wouldn't claim any Christian faith, have that inbuilt sense that there must be something, that we were made for more than this world and this earth. And of course, that's a right feeling, but it's the wrong place to look for the reassurance. We don't look to near-death experiences or these remarkable stories and think, well, now our faith has credibility, now we can believe. But rather, we base our faith and what we know about the future on God's revealed word. And you see, if we do that, then we won't then be let down by a revelation a few years down the line. This passage before us today deals with what Joel's been calling the Day of the Lord, Judgment Day, the end of history when God wraps it all up. And if you've been here the other weeks, you'll remember that there's been this locust plague that Joel has taken as a picture, foreshadowing, pointing forward to this greater disaster to come, this Day of the Lord, Judgment Day. It was 2 weeks ago, because I wasn't here last week, but 2 weeks ago we looked at the end of chapter 2 with these verses from verse 30 to 32 where Joel begins to describe this Day of the Lord. And when he moves into chapter 3, he's sort of zooming in, going into more detail on what he's already told us about this Day of the Lord in those verses. Judgment is, of course, a hard thing to talk about, a hard thing to think about. And yet there is a sense in which, a very real sense, in which judgment of God's enemies is a good thing for God's people. Now that's really a topic more for next week, when we'll see, I'll just say that again, that God's judgment of God's enemies is good news for God's people. That's really what we'll be seeing next week as we think about how God is promising to restore the fortunes of Judah in the end of the chapter. But tonight we are focusing on the judgment that comes at the end of time, the judgment day on the Day of the Lord. And the way I want to go about it is to use these verses to try and correct five mistakes that we, that people around us, that society might make about judgment day. So five mistakes, and we'll go through and try and see how this passage corrects them. The first mistake then, mistake number one, is it'll never happen. It'll never happen. You see, in our society, divine judgment has gone from being a conscious reality to being an embarrassment to be ignored to now being a caricature to be laughed at. We know it, don't we, that fire and brimstone preachers are no longer feared but ridiculed. And there's that archetypal man walking around with the sandwich board, the end is nigh. And really that's what the world thinks about divine judgment. that it's to be laughed at, that it's crazy. Now, I guess many of us wouldn't put ourselves in that camp. We're here at church. We know that there is a God, and we know that there is a God who will judge. And yet that's where the world is. 2 Peter predicts this situation. If you want the reference, it's 2 Peter 3:4, where Peter says, in the last days, scoffers will come scoffing and saying, where is this promise of his coming? Jesus said he was coming back. Been waiting a while. Where is he then? And you see, in the light of that ridicule, in the light of that scoffing around us, even those of us with a strong faith can start to think, well, maybe we're going to begin to lose our nerve here. Perhaps at the very least, we need to stop talking or thinking about judgment. But you see, as we do that, of course, the doctrine of judgment or the reality of judgment becomes, as with anything that you leave unattended, covered in dust, neglected, ultimately forgotten. But we mustn't let, as Christians, we mustn't let our understandable unease talking about judgment to lead to denying its reality. This "it'll never happen" comes from the non-Christian scoffing at the whole idea. But there's a danger that it can come from the Christian who just wants to block it out of their conscience, conscious reality. But Peter goes on. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you. Where is this promise of his coming? Where's Jesus if he said he was coming back? Peter's answer is, well, he's not slow. He's not slow in coming back. He's patient with you. And yet, despite the delay, the day of the Lord will come. Now, that's what we get here at the start of Joel chapter 3. Verse 2. God says, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them. Now, this phrase, valley of Jehoshaphat, is a bit of a weird one. Jehoshaphat literally means Yahweh has judged, the Lord has judged. So this is the valley of judgment, or as it's called later on in the chapter, the valley of decision. So we're not talking about a literal geographic place, we're talking about a symbolic place of judgment. This valley of Jehoshaphat, and that is where judgment will happen. You can buy a sofa or a car on credit and get 0% interest and pay nothing for the first year, and all these sorts of different schemes. But the day will come when you have to start repaying. And if you forget that, if you start ignoring or start living as though that day was never going to come, you're, of course, in for a nasty surprise. How much worse to ignore or forget the reality that God's judgment will come. Mistake number one, it'll never happen. God says, behold, in those days I will gather the nations, bring them into the valley, and I will enter into judgment. Which brings us on to mistake number two. Mistake number two is, well, I'll get away with it. I'll get away with it. One of the disturbing aspects of those riots a few years ago, started in Tottenham and spread to various places, one of the disturbing things was how a large number of people seemed to join in, just jump on the bandwagon. People who wouldn't normally perhaps go around vandalizing or thieving suddenly saw the opportunity to do so and joined in with the others, thinking, I'll get away with this. I'll never be caught. That sort of idea is how Joel pictures the nations, these enemy nations around Israel. You see, they have been mistreating Israel, God's people, thinking that they are immune, thinking that they will get away with it. We heard some of the things as Dave read it, but there, halfway through verse 2, they've scattered them among the nations. Verse 3, they've cast lots for my people. They've traded a boy for a prostitute, sold a girl for wine. These kind of despicable practices, human trafficking, prostitution, slavery. But in doing all that, ultimately, what have they done? Well, ultimately, they've attacked God himself. He says in verse 5, you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried my rich treasures into your temples. An attack against God's people is always an attack against God himself. And so these nations, assuming that they have got away with their crimes, are in for a nasty surprise. When the interest-free year will run out, and they suddenly find in verse 4, "Are you paying me back for something?" says God. "Do you think you're trying to get back at me?" "Well, if you are," he goes on, "I will return your payment on your head swiftly and speedily." In other words, God says, "You think you've got away with it because the judgment hasn't fallen yet, but it will fall. I will repay it on your head." And indeed, as he goes on, you find out that the judgment will be completely in proportion and completely right and true. Joel here is talking about Tyre and Sidon, the regions of Philistia. Now, those are sort of traditional enemies of Israel. Depending exactly when the book of Joel was written, depends a little bit why he picks those nations. From what I've read, I tend to plumb for Joel being written quite late after the people have come back from the exile. So therefore, these nations are being put up there as traditional enemies, like those who opposed us in the past. And so therefore, as a picture, in fact, of all the nations, of all the world, in opposition to God. So it's not just Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia. Actually, it's all the nations and all the people of the nations who think that their crimes, their sins have gone unnoticed and that they've got away with it. "No one knows. No one will hold me to account, except God does know. And God will hold all people to account." In Romans, it says that God will judge the secrets of men. Nothing will remain hidden. So mistake two is I'll get away with it, but this leads us on to mistake three. Mistake three is I'm good enough for God. I'm good enough for God. Just for a moment, I want you to think about some of the worst sins that you've had personal experience of. Some of the worst sins you've had personal experience of. Now I imagine, you can tell me afterwards if I've got this right, I imagine most of us are thinking about sins done to us rather than sins done by us. And you see, that is quite a natural reaction. If you didn't, it might show that you're a particularly holy person and in tune with your own sin. But actually, instinctively, often, we look to the wrongs of others first. You try and split up a fight between children. Say, "What happened? He, they, she." It's never, "I was selfish," or "I was too aggressive." Always outward looking first. Well, here we go with the judgment of God coming, and we read a passage like this about Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia, and we say, well, of course they won't get away with it. And of course that is good and right. We want God to be there. We want God to judge the people like them, the pimps, the human traffickers, the ethnic cleansers, the thieves, the drug addicts, the bullies, the terrorists, the suicide bombers, those who preach hate, those who incite violence. We want God to judge them. And so when we think about sin, we so often look out there that we fail to look in here. Because frankly, I look at my own life and I say, well, I'm not in that league. Okay, a few white lies here and there, a bit of careless gossip, an occasional lustful thought or angry outburst, yeah. But not like Tyre and Sidon and the regions of Philistia. Well, of course, Paul says he's the chief of sinners. And if we come to understand the gospel, really what the Bible story is all about, then we can each get to the point of agreeing. Yes, I am the chief of sinners. So there's the mistake, saying, as this judgment comes, I'm good enough for God. Now, you might not fall into that trap. I guess most of us here would be happy to call ourselves Christians tonight. And we might not fall into the trap of thinking we're good enough for God. We might be very aware of our sin. In fact, we might have such a sensitive conscience that we are fully aware of the times, again and again, day by day, that we let God down. But you see, a related mistake we can make is to think this, to think they are good enough for God. Not I'm good enough for God, but they're good enough for God. My neighbour, my friend, the person who is always willing to go out of their way for the sake of others, loves their family, raises money for charity, visits the sick. They're all right. They'll surely be okay on Judgment Day. And you see, we start to kid ourselves about that because the reality of judgment is too painful to consider. And so if we don't make the mistake of thinking we're good enough for God, perhaps sometimes we look around and think our non-Christian friends are good enough for God. But again, we're reminded of the terrible words in Romans chapter 3. No one is righteous. No, not one. All have turned away. Together have become worthless. Those of us who know the day of the Lord is coming are therefore charged with this great message to warn, to blow the trumpet, to sound the alarm, to say the judgment day is coming and I'm not good enough and you're not good enough. If there's somebody who you've been thinking about as I've been speaking for those few minutes, why not invite them to Encounters this Thursday? Bring them down so they can find out for themselves the claims of Jesus and what he has to do with them on the day of the Lord. Okay, so we've had mistake number one was it'll never happen. Mistake number two, I'll get away with it. Mistake number three, I'm good enough for God. Mistake number four, I'll fight my own corner. I'll fight my own corner. You may have seen Stephen Fry in his recent interview when he was asked what he would say if he ever met God. He's an atheist, but he was asked, what would you say if you ever met God? And it, again, has been flying around the internet. He got quite irate in the interview, quite worked up, and he said, this is what I'd say to God. Bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world to which there is such misery that is not our fault? It is not right. It is utterly, utterly evil. And I guess many of us can sort of relate to what he's saying, and certainly our non-Christian friends can. If I was to face God, I'd want some answers. Why have you allowed this and that to happen? Another atheist, Bertrand Russell, was asked what he would say if God asked why he didn't believe in him. And Russell said, not enough evidence, God. There's not enough evidence. And you see what Stephen Fry, what Bertrand Russell, and in fact what many people have in common, is this thought that actually if I come face to face with God, I'll fight my own corner. Thank you very much. I'll tell him what I think. Give him a piece of my mind and let him justify himself. But this is a tragic mistake, because when faced with the reality, the majestic presence of an all-powerful, all-creating God, no one ever answers back. Now, that's a very hard thing to think about, because we have these questions. Stephen Fry's question is a good one. Bone cancer in children, what's that about? A good question. But face-to-face with God, that is not a question you'll be asking. No one ever answers back. This is the point of verses 9 to 12. It's a great picture. And I wonder if I can help you sort of get it more into your mind. The nations here are being called to assemble for war. And you get in verse 10 this phrase, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Now you see, you might have heard that read and think, well, hang on, that sounds the wrong way round. Because actually Isaiah and Micah both use it the other way around. Isaiah and Micah look forward to this glorious future where there'll be peace, there'll be no more war. And they both prophesy saying, beat your swords into plowshares.
Here Joel is saying, no, gather the nations, call them up, and gather an army and an arsenal, arrayed in full armor. So beat your plowshares into swords. Let the weak say, I am a warrior. That's not an encouragement to say, if you're feeling low and weak and small, now you can be strong through God. This is saying, no, gather everyone. The people who would naturally be in the army, the people who wouldn't. Drag them all in, because we need a huge, mighty army, and we are going to march down to this valley of Jehoshaphat, and we are going to face God. We're going to gather our weapons, we're going to take our agricultural equipment with us, and we are going to face off with him. Here they are, marching down to the valley. And again, I don't want to be too harsh on Stephen Fry, but as he speaks, it comes across so self-righteous and self-justifying, and that's the sort of attitude that these nations have, coming down into the valley to face God. We are self-righteous, we are proud, we can do what we want, and we are going to come and face God in this ultimate, cataclysmic Armageddon battle. But then the Lord shows himself. Bring down your warriors, O Lord, it says at the end of verse 11. In other words, come on, God, where's your army? End of verse 12 says, there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. You see, when the Lord walks into the valley, he's dressed not as a soldier, but as a judge. This valley is not a battlefield, but a courtroom. Have you ever gone to work wearing your slippers? Did you ever turn up on a non-uniform day in your uniform? Sometimes it doesn't matter if you make a mistake with what you're wearing. But here it's so much more serious, because here's this massive army. They've assembled thinking that they're going to come and give God a piece of their own mind, or certainly that they are coming for a fight. And they realize they're not coming for a fight at all. They're coming for judgment. Their plowshare swords look so pathetic in their hands as the judge sits down and the true harvesting of judgment begins. This language in verse 13 of the harvesting, treading the winepress and the vats overflowing, that's picked up in Revelation as a picture of the great judgment of God. He will swing his sickle. And you see, I'm afraid the truth is that on that day, God will put all of us in our place, including Bertrand Russell, including Stephen Fry, including your friends, including your family, including you. And we will have no answer. Which leads us to mistake five. If this judgment is coming, if God's judgment is coming against the nations, but also against individuals, if it's unavoidable, if we're not good enough for God, if actually we have no chance to put our own case across because he is so almighty and all-powerful, well, we go to mistake five, which is, I'll keep my fingers crossed. Mistake five, I'll keep my fingers crossed. And perhaps this is where many people who come to church are. Perhaps this is where actually some of our friends are. They're perhaps aware that they're not as good as they should be. They're aware that God is there to judge, and yet they think, well, I'll just keep my fingers crossed. What more can I do? We touch wood, we cross our fingers, think, well, perhaps I'll get away with it. But you know, there's a better way. It's a mistake to simply keep your fingers crossed, because God has shown us a way. I just want to put up a couple of verses from Joel on the screen. Thanks, Jeff. And really, the point of this is to compare, without flicking the pages, compare a couple of verses from chapter 2 with a couple of verses from chapter 3 that we've just had read. So let me read it. From chapter 2, verse 10, the earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. We had that again in chapter 3. The sun and moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. These sort of symbols of what's happening on the day of judgment, these great things that are happening in the sky. What happens in chapter 2? The Lord utters his voice before his great army, for his camp is exceedingly great. He who executes his word is powerful. So the Lord is shouting, uttering his voice, And again we get in chapter 3, the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and the earth quake. Again picking up that language from chapter 2. So here it is. There's these signs in the sky. There is the roaring voice of the Lord. And then at the end of the chapter 2 passage, the day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? In other words, if this judgment is coming, we're for it. And so because of this comparison, you'd expect the same to be at the end of the chapter 3 passage, verse 16. But instead you get these wonderful words. Instead of saying the Lord roars his voice, who can endure it? You have the words, the Lord is a refuge to his people, a stronghold to the people of Israel. In the face of God's judgment, the question is, who can endure it? The question is, how can we possibly stand knowing our sin, knowing the sin of those around us? How can we possibly stand before a holy God? Who can endure the day of the Lord? Those who find refuge, those who find the escape route, those who shelter underneath his wing. You see, we don't endure by running away from the Lord, but by running to him, by becoming part of his people. And you say, well, how can I do that? Well, we've already had the answer. We had the answer 2 weeks ago in chapter 2, verse 32. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. It's as simple as that. It's those who call on the name of the Lord who find refuge, who find forgiveness, who find salvation. And when we think about judgment, I know that it's hard to think about because we think about those known to us. Perhaps we think about those who we've known who've died, who we think didn't ever call on the name of the Lord. Perhaps we think of those who seem to just shut down any time we try and speak to them about it. I know. And yet, we don't simply keep our fingers crossed. Oh, we know that the Lord is ready to forgive. He's ready to be a refuge. Let's just finish with this. If you flip with me to Psalm 46. It's on page 566. Psalm 46, verses 1 to 3. Perhaps familiar words. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. You see, if the Lord is your refuge, then you have nothing to fear. And that's the message that we need to get out there to those around us. And indeed, that is what we'll be picking up next week as we finish the book of Joel. For now, I'll pray. Father God, would you impress on our hearts the reality of your coming judgment, but also the wonderful reality of the refuge that you offer. Lord, keep us from becoming overwhelmed and crushed this evening, but also keep us from ignoring the warnings of your word. May we never be those who fall into these mistakes we've considered this evening, but those who know and recognize your judgment, who know and recognize our sin and our deserved punishment, and so those who call on the name of the Lord and are therefore saved. And we ask it in Jesus' name.